Welcome to episode 444 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a grand conversation with regular contributor and our resident historian, Surf William. The Surf and I get into all kinds of groovy stuff. That is history, a little sociology, some good old-fashioned humor. I think you'll enjoy it. I think you'll find it insightful and fun. From his home in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, just in from chopping some wood and tending to the chickens in the coop and such, maybe he'll play his fiddle for us. Who knows? Surf William on this week's episode. We have an EW essay titled Salad and Biscuits. We share an excerpt from acclaimed book by Tony Jensen titled Carrie, a memoir of survival on stolen land. Tony was a guest on a recent episode of Troubadours and Raconteurs, and we talked about Carrie. Great book. We have a poem called Wrench as well. And, of course, this will all be infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to be with you. Let's get to it. Episode 444 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Humming in the background, this is Salad and Biscuits. Trains, planes, automobiles, climate change, human gains, pulling the reins, trying to explain to the men and women in chains the way they might get free. It won't be from he who has the charlatan hat and twain wrapped around the objects of vain toys and magic elixirs, keeping them all connected into an ineloquent web of deceit as you stand in a proverbial cold rain shower, waiting to be devoured by the wrath of false gods and empty promises. As the pharaohs build higher towers, reaching for the sky and heavens that deep down they believe they own. And we regular Joes and Josephines, Imars, Joaquins, Adnaikas, Lamars, Carlos and Malcolm X, Jesus with Lily at Ms. Beautiful Flowers Luncheonette on Main Street Boulevard, with no regret. It's all time well spent in the classroom, in the fields, in the halls of Congress, dancing through the cityscape in a sunshine shower, just to know how it feels. As people try to conjure up the mentality to craft and foster a truer plan that will open us up and bring us closer in health, dignity, collective consciousness, toward love and integrity. These types of intelligence we would be better to fill our institutions and individual levies of human existence. My brothers, my sisters, please pass the salad and biscuits. Surf William, is that you?
Yeah, after much ado, yes, tis I.
It is so good to see you and to hear you on Troubadours and Rock On Tours yet again. Ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't had the pleasure to hear The Surf, let me give you a little background. He's an educator. He's a fiddle player, among other things. He builds chicken coops, sharpens axes and such, has videos on YouTube about axes, matter of fact. But most importantly for us, he's our resident historian. And he's coming in off the bench yet again because we had some issues with a guest that was scheduled for today. And, you know, he's always there when the moment's notice. So I appreciate that very much, Surf.
It's always my pleasure.
And I know you want to talk about one of your favorite people on the planet, the loser that is number 45. Trump. You want to talk about him a little bit?
I never want to talk about him ever, but you know, sometimes it just, you know, here's the thing. When you and I talk about that person, it's preaching to the choir. It's anticlimactic. It's a letdown. We both agree. It's where's the fun in that? I want to fight with people. I want to argue with people. I want to smack people around. That's fun.
Intellectually, you mean? Or you mean actual physical?
I said, I remember posting something on Facebook and I said, let's crush them at the polls. Let's destroy them at the polls. I'm always interested in showing that democracy can work with all of its flaws and that since our ideas are better than theirs, we will win at the ballot box. And so, of course, you know, they know I'm right. They know I'm right. And that's why they say there was fraud. Well, you can't prove there was. If there were fraud, I would love to know about it because I don't want fraudulent elections.
Well, who are they? I mean, you talk about us and them. Who are us and who are them? Who are they and who are we?
I'm glad you said that because people use that a lot. So the current leadership of the Republican Party. So you can talk about come on, help me out here.
You know McConnell, that dude?
Yeah, thank you. McConnell, Lindsey Graham, the talking heads on Fox. You know, they're all in unison. Here's their strategy. In a healthy democracy, when the vote comes in, political parties have the opportunity to say, our policies and our platform resonate with voters, and we won the election because our ideas are the ideas that voters want to see implemented. Or you can say we got our butts handed to us. We need to reevaluate our position on these policies because clearly the things we're advocating are not resonating with voters. We need to modify our policies and our platform. That's what parties do in a healthy democracy.
And historically. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And historically, and that's what you see going on in Europe now after the big elections in Germany and the Netherlands. You know, several parties won, several parties lost. The losing parties are publicly saying, we need to reevaluate our position on these policies. They might believe that their core beliefs are still correct, but clearly the way they presented their arguments or the ideas that they were presenting did not resonate with voters as much as the policies and the ideas and the politics of the other parties. So they modify their position to appeal to the voter. That's now, kind of how a democracy works.
You are our resident historian, and I was bringing up the word historically a moment ago. In this country, historically, is that the way it usually has gone down? When one party loses and loses significantly, have they in the past reflected and said, you know what, maybe we need to listen to the voters because they obviously like the other side's views more so? Is that the way it usually goes? Is this like an aberration, what's occurring now with the Trumpers and such and the Republican Party?
Yeah, and the only time, yes. So to answer your question, yes, for parties to stay viable, they go out and they look at the policies that are popular with the voting public, and they figure out ways to incorporate those policies into their platform. And you see that all over the world ever since there have been elections, going all the way back. I don't know how far back I could go, but let's go back to Otto von Bismarck, since I am a German teacher and I should know a little bit about that. Otto von Bismarck in the late 1800s decided that the German workers needed a welfare system that would allow them to be taken care of if they were injured, too sick, or too old to work. Now, Otto von Bismarck, on a personal level, didn't believe in any of that. He saw that as socialism/communism. He absolutely found it, in a way, abhorrent. But Otto von Bismarck was smart enough to know that that was the thing that was resonating with the German workforce. And Germany was bleeding workers. They were migrating to North America as quickly as they could, and to South America as quickly as they could. Germany was experiencing a brain drain. And Bismarck said, even though I'm not crazy about this idea of Medicare and Medicaid and socialized medicine and taking care of orphan children, it's not my cup of tea, but clearly it's what the vast majority of Germans are clamoring for. Our party needs to figure out a way to deliver this service to the people. Otherwise, we're going to get smashed. So Germany can thank its socialized medical system on one of the most conservative political leaders it's ever had, Otto von Bismarck.
And circa what? When was that again? When was he around?
1870s to the 1890s.
And wasn't roughly.
I'd say the 1880s.
Wasn't there a significant ship or something named after him?
Yeah.
That was blown up or something? The Bismarck? I don't know. Just yeah. Pops into my head.
It's another issue altogether. You want to go down that hole?
No, but was that named after him, you think?
Yeah, of course it was. Of course it was. Bismarck goes down as one of the greatest German leaders of the last, 150 years. He's directly responsible for, well, maybe I shouldn't say directly responsible. He's largely responsible for the concept of a German people. He's largely responsible for this idea of Germany, which is a relatively modern idea that just sort of evolved in the middle 1800s. Before that, you were Bavarian, or you were from Schleswig, or you were Niedersachsisch, but you weren't German. There really was no such thing. And Bismarck, just like in Italy, same concept.
Same time period.
Same time period, too. What Bismarck did was he understood the power of bringing all the German-speaking peoples together in one nation and the things that they could do if they all worked in unison. And, of course, he did it through war and through oppression and subjugation. But again, he wasn't a liberal. He was an arch-conservative who said, we have to provide some kind of welfare structure for our workers. Otherwise, they're simply not going to vote for us. And that's what he did.
And how does a Hitler connect to the after, the after story or the subsequent leadership role in Germany, as does Trump to maybe, I don't know, an LBJ or, the Great Society? Is it the same sort of, not evolution. I don't want to use that word because that suggests progress, but it's the same sort of trek from thinking about larger society as the Great Society did, and as Bismarck, you're saying, did, to fascism and being just totally about dividing judging and saying you're not good enough, you're lazy, you don't fit in. Is there any parallel there? Are these cyclical representations of how we behave as humans from one country, Germany, to the United States? Do you see anything there?
Well, that's a dense subject, but I can answer.
I'm a dense guy, so what do you expect?
You are dense indeed. Listen. Hitler was the antithesis. Hitler's politics were antithetical to Bismarck's politics. Bismarck understood that democracy was clearly the trend that was across Europe, and that either you could modify your policies to appeal to a democracy, to appeal to the voter, or you can smash democracy and establish a totalitarian, authoritarian regime and say democracy is BS. And we don't care what the voter thinks. We're going to impose our will upon the populace. So, if you're talking about, how does Hitler, what does Hitler represent in terms of the evolution of German politics? Well, he represents a de-evolution in German politics, because at least up until that point, Germany was practicing some form of democracy where responsible leaders tailor their policies to the population so that they win elections. Hitler was the antithesis of that. Hitler said, we don't even need democracy. We need one party that's going to impose its will on the people. So you know, there almost is no comparison between Hitler and Bismarck. They were both to the right of the political spectrum, but I believe that that's where the comparisons end.
Well, then what about, do you think there's a comparison between the period of de-evolution from Bismarck to Hitler as from LBJ to Trump, although the time period's shorter? Do you think it's a similar sort of de-evolution and mentality? I mean...
Well, go ahead.
No, that's it.
Well, first of all, LBJ was a Democrat and Trump was a Republican. That's the first thing. Secondly, no, again, Trump is almost the antithesis of LBJ. LBJ was a political animal to his core. So LBJ understood that. Now, not only was LBJ political, but I also believe that LBJ had a sense of what was needed in this country for us to evolve and move forward. And I mean, let's face it, the Civil Rights Act was passed under the Johnson administration with a lot of help from the president, twisting arms and doing those backroom deals that LBJ was so famous for. And he did that even while admitting that, and he was off, but he said after the Civil Rights Act, he said, the Democrats just lost the South for the next 50 years. Well, he probably could have said the Democrats just lost the South for the next 100 years, because LBJ understood that even though the Civil Rights Act was the morally and ethically right thing to do, politically it was going to hurt. But LBJ was willing to take that risk. As a Southern white man who was raised in Texas, he was willing to take that
political
risk.
Yes, he was conservative.
Because it was the right thing to do.
He was conservative before.
Yeah, he was very conservative. Yeah.
As was Bismarck, as you're saying. That's why I see parallels there. And then we end up, you pay for that, you know, it seems. Like people, I mean, there's so many other factors involved, especially with Hitler. You have World War I that, you know, informs why the people of Germany were so willing to follow a maniac like Hitler. But nonetheless, I wonder sometimes if we don't feel comfortable with being open, so to speak, and welcoming, and as people in society, we do that for a little bit, and then we're like, oh my god, let's tighten it up, let's start dividing, let's, you know, is that who we are, or do we get bamboozled by those who have their hands on the levers of power and access to policy and such? That's what I wonder.
Okay, well, those are valid questions. I think the political pendulum does swing. I think that's a cyclical thing, like you said earlier, and I think the pendulum swings. You know, what's the question here? What are we asking? Are we asking if there is an element in every society that is xenophobic and closed off and frightened of the other? Yeah, that element exists in every society. Is there likewise an element in almost every society we can name that's more open, more liberal, more progressive, more willing to make those advantages open to people of other origins, ethnicities, races, religions? Yeah, that exists too. Oftentimes it's who can brand themselves the best and who can deliver the slickest message to the consumer slash electorate. You know, I don't know what to say about that. I think if we're talking about the most recent election in America, I think that the American people spoke loud and clear. We do not want our political leadership to look like Donald Trump. That was a very, very clear message that the voting population sent to both political parties. One political party said, we hear you, we are going to rule, we are going to now govern with your interests at heart, and we are going to try to honor the policy platform that we put forth in the election. And the other party said, you didn't win, even though they did win, and we're the rightful winners, and you cheated, and that's how you won. So no, we're not going to reevaluate our policies because our policies are just fine. The other side cheated. So that's a classic move by the losing party and by the party that really is anti-democratic, because there's no better way to undermine our democratic institutions than to keep repeating the lie that the election was stolen, that there was widespread fraud, that the people who are now in power are not the legitimate governing party. that's the one of the greatest ways to undermine the confidence in our democratic system. And that's exactly what the Republican Party is engaging in a systematic and coordinated way, which should frighten everybody.
Right. And it's ironic because they are the party that oftentimes waves the flag and talks about patriotism. But this is totally, it's totally un-American. It's totally unpatriotic. Yeah, this sounds like Banana Republic. Mentality.
All the things that the Republicans. Here's the thing. This is why I call the Republicans frauds.
Give us that little analysis. That very succinct analysis about if you're a Republican, you must be, and then you can go off on that.
Oh, there's no one's ever proven me wrong. If you vote Republican, you are either mean, dumb, or rich,
or more than one of those. You could be all of them,
or any or all of those. But you are at least one of those things if you vote Republican. And I know you and I one time discussed it, and you were throwing some hypotheticals at me, and you know you still didn't dissuade me from that maxim. If one votes Republican, one is either ignorant, mean, or rich, or a combination of all of those.
Yeah. Yeah,
I stand by that. And again, I want someone to prove, I want someone to present the hypothetical voter to me who doesn't fit into one of those categories. And I will say to that person, you can't do it. I would love it if somebody could, but you can't.
No. And right now, looking at where we are as an historian yourself, you know, a student of history, a teacher of history, what do you think is going to be looked at in the future about what is going on now as significant and maybe shameful or maybe something that people will be in awe of in a positive sense?
I have two ways of looking at this. One is, you know, we should all be a little bit scared and a little bit nervous about the direction that our politics are going in. In other words, we actually have one of two major political parties in this country that's trying to undermine all of the institutions that we've all been brought up to revere. So all of our democratic institutions, whether they're governing bodies, whether they're judicial, whether they're executive branch, we actually have a party that co-governs this country that is trying to undermine and discredit and cast into doubt all of that stuff that we've always believed were like the values of this nation. So, you know, the separation of powers in government, the sanctity of elections, respect for authority, respect for the laws of the land. You actually have a political party now that's saying, no, if you don't like those institutions, if they don't seem to reflect your values, then you should absolutely work not to elect people who reflect your values, but rather you should actively work to overthrow those institutions. We saw that on January 6th. That's exactly what January 6th was. That was a group of people who could not accept a democratic outcome of an election. So what was their alternative? They had a choice there. They had one choice, which was we need to examine our policies and determine why the majority of American people are rejecting them, or we can overthrow the institutions that that these elections have chosen to support, and we can do what? I don't know, revolt and overthrow the government and impose our will on the people undemocratically. That's a scary thought, and that's coming from one of the actual sitting president of the United States. I think that's pretty unprecedented.
And some now, people in Congress too.
No doubt. Now, before I say the sky is falling, I would say this. I think where we are currently politically is just, again, it's an extension of where we've always been as a nation. There have always been deep, deep divides in this country between rich and poor, between north and south, between urban and rural, between black and white. That is part and parcel of the American experience. It's a little unpleasant and a little ugly to talk about, but it's a political and social reality of America that those deep, deep divides have always existed. My goodness, 170 years ago, we fought a war. Two standing armies went against each other. How much more divided can a country be? We were at war for 4.5 years.
Yeah, the Civil War, obviously, you're talking about. Yeah. And some people say we're still fighting it.
Well, we are. And there's a lot of reasons for that, too. But my larger point is simply this. we have always been deeply, deeply divided. So the things we're seeing now, I'm sorry, they are not new. They are just a new manifestation of the same old political divisions and social and ethnic and racial divisions that we've seen in this country since its founding, since before its founding.
Yeah, and the same manipulations being done to the electorate. You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Yeah, of course, of course. Yeah. But I don't want to be too Pollyanna, and I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I always say, look, before one starts to say, oh my goodness, this is unprecedented, we've never been in a position like this before, I just like to remind them that there was this thing called the Civil War where we actually killed almost 700,000 of our fellow countrymen. That's a pretty strong indication that these people have problems with each other.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And when you look at some of the players, so to speak, in politics and even social movements, maybe an artist or two pops into your head. Right now, are you looking at anybody that is inspiring you with the way they're approaching things, the way they are addressing some of the strife that does indeed exist at this moment?
I don't necessarily turn to our political leadership for, moral and spiritual and ethical encouragement. Not that they're not out there. Not that there aren't politicians out there that really are trying to do a good job. I find myself more and more, I find myself more and more turning to spiritual leaders, philosophers, people who question people. I turn more towards people who have questions rather than answers. That tends to be the way I keep myself sane.
Like a Michael Luby.
For those of you who don't know who Michael Luby is, he's a well-known philosopher from the Green Ridge section of Scranton. He's been known to pontificate on matters of music and spirituality and beer. And I just want to let your listeners know who Michael Luby was.
Thank you for filling that in. So as of late then, you're looking at is it a Buddhist? I know a lot of times you're into Buddhism. Are you looking at Marx again? Are you reading a little Marx, or are you somewhere new?
I try to right now my reading is I'm reading a book on linguistics right now because I've been tasked with creating a new course offering at our high school. So we're working on developing a new curriculum for a linguistics course. I'm going to put linguistics in air quotes because it's a very, very basic, introduction to the evolution of language. So I've been reading a lot about that lately. And I'm kind of fascinated with this notion of language and culture. And does the culture influence the language, or does the language influence the culture, or is it a two-way street? Is it a mix of both of them? And again, as in most subjects, I'm in kindergarten here, but I'm just now, diving into this this topic of linguistics. As far as philosophy goes, I've been finding my philosophy in not to sound too trite, but like my walks in the woods and my splitting firewood and my hikes with my dog and things like that. I'm finding that to just have some quiet time in nature really helps me to just keep things in perspective. As an aside, I'm watching a really good series. Alex and I are watching a series on Apple Plus. It's called The Morning Show, and it's the behind the scenes machinations of a morning news show like Good Morning America. And it's dealing with all of the issues that have been blowing up in the past couple of years, sexual harassment and discrimination and the pandemic and racism and sexism. And, when I look at the lives that these people, yes, these are fictional characters, but that in the high stakes world of, for example, entertainment, there's a lot of nastiness that goes on. And I look at Alex all the time when we're watching this and I say, how do these people exist in that world? I'm much too fragile. I'm a fragile flower. If I tried to compete against these sharks, they would just chew me up and spit me out. And I contrast it with my life, where I really do try to avoid conflict as much as I can. I'm not afraid of a fight, and I'm not afraid of confrontation, but I can't imagine living every day in a constant state of confrontation and aggression. I can't imagine what that does to you emotionally and spiritually. For example, if you're like an attorney, if you're a trial attorney, you know, then your whole life and your whole professional career revolves around confrontation. And I just think to myself, I'm trying in my profession and in my personal life, I try always to find commonality, and I try to find reconciliation, and I try to find ways for people to come together, even if we disagree. And I just think that to exist in that world where you're constantly at war and fighting all the time, even if it's part of your career, like an attorney, I just think that would become too emotionally and spiritually draining for me. I don't think I could handle it, at least at this point in my life.
No, I hear you. I hear you. I think, you know, you can't avoid, as you mentioned earlier, conflict, because it's part of life. So to get all insulated, you're not really living life. But to look for conflict and to be underhanded when it arises, to not be rational, to not be ethical, that's not okay. That's not healthy. But conflict is inevitable, because, especially in a free, open society, because people feel more comfortable and to be who they want to be, to question what they don't like and to support things that they do. So I just wanted to put that in there. Conflict is not a bad thing.
Conflict occurs. Conflict is part of the human experience. Conflict resolution is the thing that takes a sort of higher intellectual, spiritual will. It's easy to fight.
Right.
The difficult part is making up. The difficult part is finding commonality, finding common ground with your enemy, and actually acknowledging that, you know, you understand they might have a point that they can make. And this is getting back to our original point. This is why I lament the current state of our politics, because discussion and debate is the way we find solutions to complicated issues. If we can't have meaningful, respectful, civil discussion about issues, how can we ever expect to find consensus and to find solutions that everybody might find somewhat palatable, if not fully, totally agreeable? What you're seeing from the right, more from the right than from the left, in my opinion, what you're seeing from the right is an anti-intellectualism and an anti-intellectualism and a fanaticism that shuts out any opportunity. It's not just from the right. It is from the left too, and I'm guilty of it too. But you're seeing a fanaticism that's shutting down dialogue between left and right. And that's simply not going to be good for anybody, because even if you win the debate, the other side is still going to walk away saying that they are not going to abide by the outcome, or they simply think you weren't being an honest broker and they're just not going to respect your position, your authority, your winning of the election. Instead of acknowledging that you won and they need to reevaluate, they're going to say there's in some way you cheated or you're not authentic, and therefore they are justified in continuing to attack you without anybody really seeking resolution and solutions to these problems. And I think where we've really been let down is by our political leadership, and specifically the political leadership on the right, because we do expect political leaders to be more educated and more balanced. And what you're seeing on the right is a pandering to the lowest common denominator, namely Donald Trump. That's extremely disappointing.
Well said, Surf William. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Again, thank you for coming in off the bench, literally at a moment's notice, to help us out here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. And I know you're announcing a football game today at your high school in a couple of hours.
Senior night.
Excellent. You're a good teacher, a good community citizen, and I'm proud to have you on the program. Thank you so much, Surf William.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun.
Talk with you soon, hopefully in person.
Okay, peace.
Ciao, fratello.
Ciao.
Ayla. Hey.
And now an excerpt from the highly acclaimed memoir of survival on stolen land called Carrie by Toni Jensen. Chapter 1, Women in the Fracklands. On Magpie Road, the colors are in riot. Sharp blue sky over green and yellow tall grass that rises and falls like water in the North Dakota wind. Magpie Road holds no magpies, only robins and crows. A group of magpies is called a tiding, a gulp, a murder, a charm. When the men in the pickup make their first pass there on the road, you are photographing the grass against sky, an ordinary bird blurring over a lone rock formation. You do not photograph the men, but if you had, you might have titled it Father and Son Go Hunting. They wear camouflage, and their mouths move in animation or argument. They have their windows down, as you have left those in your own car down the road. It is warm for fall. It is grouse season, and maybe partridge, but not yet waterfowl. Despite how partridge are in the lexicon vis-a-vis pear trees and holiday singing, the birds actually make their homes on the ground. You know which birds are in season because you are from Iowa, another rural place where guns and men and shooting seasons are part of the knowledge considered common. Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary defines in season in relation to timing, levels of fitness, and whether a thing is, quote, legally available to be hunted or caught. The first use of off-season comes in 1847. Definitions include, number one, a time of suspended or reduced activity, especially the time during which an athlete is not training or competing. Definition 2, a period of time when travel to a particular place is less popular and prices are usually lower. And definition 3, sports, a period of time when official games, tournaments, etc. are not being played. Magpie Road lies in the middle of the 1,028,051 acres that make up the Little Missouri National Grassland in western North Dakota. Magpie Road lies about 200 miles north and west of the Standing Rock Reservation, where thousands of indigenous people and their allies have come together to protect the water, where sheriff's men and pipeline men and National Guardsmen have been donning their riot gear, where those men still wait, where they still hold tight to their riot gear. If a man wears his riot gear during prayer, will the sacred forsake him? If a man wears his riot gear to the holiday meal, how will he eat? If a man enters the bedroom in his riot gear, how will he make love to his wife? If a man wears his riot gear to tuck in his children, what will they dream?
This is how you make yourself vanish into nothing. And this is how you make yourself worthy of the love that she gave to you back when you didn't own a beautiful thing. And this is how you make yourself call your mother. And this is how you make yourself closer to your brother. Remember him back when he was small enough to help you sing. You thought God was an architect. Now you know he's something like a pipe bomb ready to blow. And everything you built, it's all for show, goes up in flames in 24 frames. This is how you see yourself floating on the ceiling, and this is how you help her when her heart stops beating. What happened to the party? This is how you talk to her when no one else is listening. And this is how you help her when the muse goes missing. You vanish so she can go drowning in a dream again. You thought God was an architect. Now you know he's something like a pipe bomb ready to blow. And everything you built that's all.
Piano and bench. Atop its wood encasement is a rusty old plumber's pipe wrench. She left it there after fixing the screen door. The bathroom tub does not leak anymore. And I am still trying to figure out which chore to abhor more. Thank you. And there you have it, episode 444 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Surf William, as well as author Tony Jensen, and these musical artists: Thelonious Monk, The Talking Heads, Alice Clark, Hugh Masekela, Jason Isbell, John Pizzarelli, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.